Evening. Let's go to it. We're actually going to jump a couple of chapters. You may realize it feels to me like the last few weeks have been one problem after another for the Israelites. It's been one grumble after another. Exodus chapter 19 is where we're going to go to. Chapter 17 was going to be the next one, but it was another grumble, and I thought, I really don't want to do another grumble this evening. Where the water from the rock, and they got thirsty, and they grumbled against Moses. So I thought, we've had enough grumbling, haven't we? let's move to something altogether. I'm not saying that that's not valuable, but for us, we're going to move on. Chapter 18 is Jethro and Moses. There's plenty of good stuff in there, but it's not where I want to go this evening. We're going to get to Sinai, which, if you've read much of the Bible, if you know much about it, the events of Sinai are some of the key events in the nation's history, the nation of Israel. I would say it's kind of one of the biggest pivot points in Israel's history. It's certainly one of the most important, one of the most significant events for them then and in subsequent history. And in the two chapters we're going to look at tonight, 19 and 20, we're going to see how the covenant that God originally made with Abraham 400 years before, how it's reaffirmed and enlarged and developed in a way. The covenant that we're going to look at this evening, that God makes with his people at Sinai, it's not new, because he's made it before with Abraham, but he's going to give it a new and radical edge. It's rather like the next stage of the development of what's gone before, so he's going to be putting flesh on the bones, so to speak. With Abraham, he promised Abraham that he'd make his family a great nation, that he'd give him a land, and he'd make his name, the name of Abraham, known through all the world. Now, as we get to chapter 19, all of that is about to be made a whole lot more concrete. So I want us to read. At this point, we'll read chapter 19, and then a little bit later, we'll read chapter 20. So Exodus 19. In the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on the very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they had set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my commandment, my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words you're to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, "I am going to come to you in a dense cloud, so that people will hear me speaking with you and will always put their trust in you." Then Moses told the Lord what the people had said. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Make them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day. Because on that day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not go up to the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. He shall be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they go up to the mountain. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them, and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the third day. Abstain from sexual relations. On the morning of the third day, there were thunder and lightning and a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke, because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently. I thought of that when I was watching the pictures of Nepal this week. There were some video clips of people. There were some people on Mount Everest. I don't know if you saw them. And there was the whole place was shaking. And there was dust rising up, and the whole thing was moving. I just thought of this, what it must have been like. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. So Moses went up, and the Lord said to him, go down and warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord will break out against them. Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai because you yourself warned us. Put limits around the mountain and set it apart as holy. The Lord replied, go down and bring Aaron up with you. But the priests and the people must not force their way through to come up to the Lord, or he will break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them. I read that and I think Moses must have been pretty tired. There was a lot of going up the mountain and coming down the mountain, going back up the mountain, going back down the mountain, going back up the mountain, going back down the mountain, before he finally went back up again to get the words from the Lord in the Ten Commandments. What's happening here is the Lord is bringing to Israel this particular arrangement with them. He's formalizing what he has said. He's forming them now from just simply being the family of Abraham, the descendants of Abraham. He's making them into a nation. A nation is going to be codified by the laws which he's going to give to them to guide them. But he's bringing to them, and he reminds them how he's brought them up out of Egypt. What he reminds them what he's done to Egypt. And he reminds them how he brought them up like an eagle. The picture is of an eagle carrying the chicks on its back. Well, that actually doesn't happen. But it's a picture of the eagle just picking them up and carrying them. It wasn't anything they had done themselves. That's the point, to get out of Egypt. It wasn't what they did, was it? It was all of God. He'd picked them up. He'd carried them. He'd done it all himself. It wasn't their effort. And he kept them safe. And he says it's for a reason. In verse 5, he says, you're going to be my treasured possession. Now, if you'll obey me fully and keep my commandment, my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. And it says that everything belongs to the Lord, although the whole earth is mine. So the whole earth belongs to him. But these people would be special. They would be like the apple of his eye. They would be particularly treasured. So all the people are his children, but he's going to have some favored children. We would say you shouldn't have favored children. But bless God that he does, because we've been brought into that. And that's what Israel were brought into, to be his special people. They were going to be treasured by him, particularly, particularly well-treated, particularly supported, particularly protected. They were going to have privileges, and they'd got this special purpose as well. They were going to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, he says in verse 6. The whole earth is mine. You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That is, what does it mean to be a kingdom of priests? Well, you know what the role of a priest did? The priest was the mediator, the go-between between God and the people. And he says, you're going to be the nation. As a nation, you're going to be that. You're going to be a nation that represents me before the nations around. You're going to bring me to those people, and you're to bring those people to me. You're going to be a kingdom of priests. You're to be a holy nation. Holy means to be different, set apart. You're not just going to be any group of people. You're going to be set apart for me. It's not to mean they were going to exclude others, but it means that they were to live in a way where their life, the conduct of the nation, the way the nation ordered itself, was so obviously better than the nations around that they became attractive to the nations. So they would become like magnets. And others would see the way the Israelites lived as a nation. And they would say, that's genius. That's the way to do it. That's what we need to be like. We need to be following their God. We need to do things their way so that others would want to join them. That's the point of it. Kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You know, the same language is used about us, isn't it, in the New Testament? In 1 Peter chapter 2, you're not to be like that, for you are a, and he's talking to New Testament believers, after the time of Jesus. This is not talking to Jews, this is talking to the followers of Jesus. For you are a chosen people, royal priests, a holy nation, God's very own possession. So what God did for the nation of Israel is what he's done for us. For you as an individual, he called you by name. He added you into his people, into his family. As a result, you can show others the goodness of God. For he called you out of the darkness into his wonderful light. There we've got our purpose. That's what we're here for. It's God's people. A priesthood. Representing God, demonstrating him, a holy nation. God's purpose in saving us is not ultimately for our good. God's purpose in saving you is not ultimately for your good. We get to be the beneficiaries of God's grace, but ultimately it's not about you and it's not about me. It's about him. It's about his glory. He's called us for his sake. It's all ultimately about God. So we may well ask ourselves as we pass through here, what are we living for? As we sit here this evening, as you sit here this evening, what is your priority? Someone spoke to me this week and they were talking about getting some me time. It's a very modern kind of expression, wanting me time. You know, the Bible never speaks about me time. The Bible speaks about God's time. We're here for God, 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year. It's about God. We're called to be royal priests, a holy nation, God's very own possession. This was the offer that Moses was to take to the people. Because it says, you notice what it says, if you've got your Bibles open, it says, now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of the nations you will be my treasured possession. So, verse 7, Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people, so the representatives of the people, and set before them, he told them the words of the Lord that he'd commanded him to speak, the words that God had given him. And the people responded together. So there was a unanimous kind of response from the people. We will do everything that the Lord has said. We'll do it. There's this offer from God. If you will do this, if you'll agree with me to let me do this, then I will do that. Yes, we will. Count us in. And we might say, well, who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? And yet there are people today, you know them and I know them, that the offer goes out and God says, I want you to be one of my special people. I want you to come to me. I want you to save you. I want to give you life now. I want to forgive you. I want to come and be your God and your guide and your protector, your provider. I want to give you a much greater purpose in life. I want to give you a structure and a framework, and I want to give you hope for eternity. And still people will walk away. It's not a given that people will respond to the Lord. And so 3 days later, verse 16, the people assemble and the mountain starts to shake and thunder and lightning blaze and rumble and the heavenly trumpet call is heard. The trumpet was the summonsing. That was the way they got people's attention. They would just blow a trumpet in those days. So this is God saying, listen to me. Gather yourselves together. Something important is about to be said. And when you put yourself in that position, you kind of imagine where they were. And the mountain rumbling, shaking, smoking, the thunder and the lightning and this unseen but blasting all around trumpet call. It's no wonder that the people were afraid, is it? They're so scared that they keep away and they say to Moses, look, we can't go. We don't want to go near that God. Will you be our representative? Will you be our go-between? You go and talk to him because we daren't. You just come back and tell us what he says and we'll be okay with that. As one writer that I read this week says, the stage is set for God to tell the people how he wants them to live. The preliminaries are over. The people are convinced that God is a God to be reckoned with, an unapproachable God of power and might. But at the same time, we discover that paradoxically, he's a God who wants a special relationship with his people. He wants to know them personally. So here is his God, thunder and lightning. And yet he's calling the people to him. And this whole thing of Moses going up and down, to and fro, it's about relationship, isn't it? It's about God connecting with the people, not just being out there somewhere. And it's against that background, that with that covenant agreement, that God then gives them the rules of the covenant. This is how I want you to live. If you're going to be those people, if you're saying that you'll let me be your God, you'll let me do that and you are agreeing to go with me, then these are the rules. And that's where we get to chapter 20. That's where they fit in. So let's read a little bit of chapter 20 as well. I wonder when the last time was that you read the Ten Commands. It's been a long time since I've done that in church. Shame on us, maybe. Exodus chapter 20. Let's hear the word of the Lord. And God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, just keep in mind as we read this, the situation, where they are, the context in which he's speaking. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien among you within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So those are the laws, those are the rules that are to govern them. And they would both protect them. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? Do those things, there's a level of protection there. And it would also set them apart from the nations around them. They were never meant to be harsh dictates that would hem them in, that would spoil their fun. But it was a provision that would allow them to stay close, in close friendship and fellowship with God. And to live as a people that demonstrated the nature and the character of the God that they served and followed. The way of the Lord that's set out here would be completely alien to the nations around. They were to be this holy nation set apart to attract people to God. Let's have a quick tour through those commands. Here they are. It starts with this establishment of the exclusive relationship with God. You shall have no other gods before me. That's important because for centuries they'd lived in the Egyptian culture that had many gods, a plethora of gods. They'd just worship whichever one they wanted. That would have been normal to them. That's how this group of people would have been thinking. They work with God. And God says, no. For me, it's one God. He's the sovereign Lord. And you're not to be going after those other gods. All the other gods are false gods. You mustn't be distracted by them. It's got to be an exclusive relationship. One God. Similarly, he goes on to say that they're not to make idols or images to aid them in worship. Why? The nations around had their gods. They'd have the sun god. They'd have their gods made of stone and wood, and they'd have their animals. The point is, if you set yourself up and you draw a picture of what you think God is like, you're always going to underplay him, aren't you? How could you possibly portray Jehovah? How could they, with their limited understanding, they're going to go on and they're going to make a golden calf. What was wrong with the golden calf? The calf was known for its strength, but that was all. It was limiting God. That was the point. He said, I don't want you to make anything that limits me. And whenever we start to make a God, and we make a God of our own imaginations, you know, we think God is like this, and we'll make a caricature of God. It won't be what he's really like. And so he says, don't make a picture, because I will not be like anything that you make. You draw a picture of me, you make a statue, you do a carving, I can guarantee, says God, I'm not like that. So don't even bother to try. I am bigger than your imagination. I am bigger than anything that you can dream of. That's what he's saying here. And kind of like to reinforce that, he talks about his name. You're not to take the name of the Lord God in vain. You're not to use even his name in a vacuous, meaningless way. What's that about? The point is, the God who's introducing himself here is so special. He's so other. He's so holy that even his name is to be revered. You can't just treat him in any way lightly. And all this is designed to create and establish that their God was not like anything else they'd ever known. Way too special, way too mighty, way too powerful, way too different to be thought of like any other God. Not to treat him lightly. They may seem a bit OTT, but I think we need this kind of instruction as well. Lest we kind of bring down, because we worship the same God, don't we? We just need to remember that the God that we worship is not a God to be trifled with. Sometimes we treat him as almost like a little pocket thing, and we pull him out like a lucky charm. And we say, well, I'll pray to God. And we treat him as if God is there for us. He's our little poodle to make life better for us. Wow. God of the Bible. He's one that we should be in awe of. Hardly daring to approach, because he's so special. That's the wonder is that he's given us Jesus, hasn't he? And he says, I want you to come. I am special, but I want you to come. I want you to be my people. And what we will see is probably next time, because they were going to break these laws, they couldn't keep them, it would alienate them, so he made the sacrificial system to deal with their sins so that they could come back. But I just want to put God up there tonight. God is an awesome God. The fourth command is kind of a bridging one where it talks about the Sabbath, because it affects both the way the people relate to God and the way they relate to each other. They're to remember the Sabbath day by keeping it different. That's the word holy. That's what it means. It means keep it different from the rest. It was a day on which they were not to work, nor were they to ask others in their household to work. They weren't to get their servants to work. Nor were they to make their animals work. It was a day of rest. It was a day for the community to stop doing the things they'd done the rest of the time and to enjoy creation like God did. And when we enjoy creation, what will we do? If we enjoy it for our own sake, we become self-centered. But the point of real enjoyment is that we appreciate the creation, because it takes us to God. How many of us find that so often our lives are so busy, we don't get a chance to actually enjoy what we have? Nothing wrong with enjoying what we have. Enjoying our health, our strength, our families, the time, the possessions, our houses, some of us, our gardens. Those holidays. Nothing wrong with those things at all. They should take us to think about God. The God who made those things, the God who's given us those things. You see, so Sunday, and many of us grew up with this whole thing, you can't do this on a Sunday. And kind of like Sunday was the day it just stopped everything. It kind of squashed everything. You didn't have fun on a Sunday. Actually, Sunday's the day that we should have. Fun doesn't seem to be the right word. But on the other hand, in our culture, Sunday should be a good day. It's not a day to spoil everything. It was a day of rest. It was a day to enjoy God. It was a day to be able to think about him, to glory in him, to glory in all that he's done and all that he's given, because the rest of the day they were working the socks off. It was a subsistence living. They lived, they worked to live. They didn't have enjoyment. So God says, look, just one day, stop working so you've got some time. Time to enjoy the fruit of your work, the fruit of your labor. But time to be with me, to thank me, to worship me. It goes back to God. And that's what our Sunday should be about. It's about reveling in, exulting in, rejoicing in the glory and the goodness of God. And I've come to realize, the same as most of you have as well, if not all of you, that actually rejoicing in the glory and the goodness of God is not just about reading holy stuff and doing holy stuff. But sometimes I can enjoy the glory of God by watching telly. Sometimes I can rejoice in the glory of God by going swimming, by enjoying the glory of creation, enjoying my family, just taking time out, just thanking God. Never do it for its own sake. Always make it reflect God. The focus ultimately on Him. It's not just about our own enjoyment and our own pleasure. It's always got to go back to God. The rest of the commandments, well, they really deal with how we relate to one another. And that's just as important as the way we treat God. For the nation to be a beacon and a light to the nations, their relationship and their care for their community and within the community was absolutely crucial. In essence, the way they were to treat one another, the way that God had treated them. In your own time, just go back and read what God says to them, the way they're to treat them, and look, and you'll see, that's the way that God treated them, with faithfulness and love and gentleness and kindness and patience and perseverance, despite the provocation that they gave Him. And we might say, if we bring it into the New Testament, that these adopted children, because that's the expression, isn't it, that the New Testament uses, that God's adopted us into His family. It's like the adopted children are to take on the characteristics of their father that's adopted them. That's what He wants us to do. He wants us to value life. He wants us to respect truth. He wants us to respect property, to respect faithfulness and being satisfied. All of those things, they're the nature, they're the characteristic of God. And He wants us to be like Him. So that's the Ten Commandments. You never heard the Ten Commandments preached on so quickly. All ten of them summarized through that way. But that's the Ten Commandments. Just a little question as we draw to conclusion tonight. How do we relate to the Ten Commandments? Because they were given, you understand now where they fitted in. They were the laws to framework and guide the nation, God's people around. How do we relate to them? Do we have to keep them in the same way as they did? Well, the point is we no longer relate to God in the same way. Our relationship with God isn't governed by the way we do the Ten Commandments or not. They don't have the same authority over us. Why not? Because we have Jesus. We're not dependent upon the law. And one of the things that we learned in our series of in Galatians, in our life groups, is that we've been set free from the law because of Jesus. Jesus fulfilled the law for us. He kept the law for us. We are right with God, not because we keep laws and rules. We are right with God because we believe in Jesus, don't we? We're trusting Jesus. We're dependent upon Him. The Old Testament Israelites were dependent on keeping the law to keep in relationship with Him. We have Jesus. He kept the law and He fulfilled it. But that said, they're still good for us, aren't they? One of my favorite kind of challenges for people is, you know, when they talk about Christianity and whatnot and express disbelief, is just posing the question, has the Ten Commandments ever been bettered? There's no society in the world that's superseded and gone better than Ten Commandments. They just make sense. Interestingly, Jesus actually strengthened them. Because He said it's not just about committing adultery, just picking on one. He said, you think about a woman, you think about a man in an appropriate way, that's as good as doing it. And stealing, you just think about it. That's the effect of doing it, the thing. It's not just the actions, it's the thoughts as well. How high God's standard is. How we need a Savior to intercede for us, don't we? To deal with the failures when we fall below God's standard that He's set for us. And so, as we live with God's laws, with the standards that he set for us. As the closer we keep these rules, the more we are these beacons of light where God has placed us, in our road, in your place of work. When you on the internet, when you're on Facebook, here's a challenge for us. Those of you who go on Facebook, what do people see of God in your posts? The attitudes that you show, the words that you use, would people ever know that you're a Christian? We're called to be beacons of light. The way that we say, the way we respond to things. I look at some posts from people who would claim to be Christians and I think, whoa, really? If in any doubt, don't put it on. It's so easy to be anonymous and negative and critical and kind of edgy when people don't see you face to face, and we say things that online and in texts and those kind of things that we'd never say to a person's face. Does it honor God? Is it going to speak well of him? Will it do well? You see, we are God's treasured possession. We're extra special. We are those in whom God takes delight. But that brings with it a responsibility. A responsibility that we live well. That we live in a way that causes people to think well of him. There's a wonderful privilege that's ours. But there's a huge responsibility as well. So the challenge for us is in every aspect of our life, every aspect of our life, to have it governed by God. Will this word, will this decision, will this thing that I'm about to do, will it reflect well on God? Will it cause people to think better of him or not? And if in doubt, think, would Jesus have done it? It's a much maligned thing, this WWJD. It's a bit old hat now, but actually it's very good. What would Jesus do? If he was here in my situation, would he do this? Would he say this? Is this action, is this decision going to reflect well on him? Can I do this for his glory? Will he be pleased with me for this? This isn't to heap guilt on us, to make us living in fear, but to remind us of our calling, to keep our focus and our direction and our purpose. God would, because that's what we've been called for. God's treasured possession. May he help us to live like that for his name's sake.